Is this the speakerphone argument? So is the appellee on?
Thank you, Judge. The greatest legal engine ever invented for the discovery of the truth, cross-examination. In light of the Sixth Amendment, in light of the Supreme Court's decisions in Bruton, Roberts, Lilly, and Crawford, in light of fundamental fairness and justice, I stand before this court today on behalf of Robert Binns, humbly asking the court to review a decision of the District Court for the Eastern District of Wisconsin. I stand before this court today to ask that Robert Binns be afforded his right to a fair criminal trial. On August 4th, 1987, the body of Sandra Leeson, a bartender at a tavern in Green Bay, Wisconsin, was found in the Michikani Forest, about 20 miles from where she was last seen by witnesses. That same day, police questioned David Binns. David Binns told police that he had driven his brother, petitioner Robert Binns, and a friend to the tavern two nights earlier, but he stayed in the car. David did admit, however, to calling the bar later because he was upset at the price his brother had paid for the beer. David's statement that day was subsequently reduced to writing.
Was any effort made to get him to testify by giving him immunity or?
No, Your Honor. No arrest was made in connection with Sandra Leeson's death. In March of 1998, nearly 11 years later, an inmate of the Oshkosh Correctional Facility, Gary Swenby, approached corrections supervisor about some statements his cellmate, David Binns, had made regarding his possible involvement in the death of Miss Leeson. With the encouragement of the correction personnel, Gary Swenby elicited further statements from David. Detective Hagland of the Green Bay Police Department came to the facility a month later and took a written statement from Swenby about his alleged conversations with David Binns. Detective Hagland then interrogated David Binns, and after several hours, David simply rubber-stamped Swenby's statement. David Binns and Robert Binns were eventually convicted of murdering Sandra Leeson, though no physical evidence could link them to the crime.
When you he rubber-stamped Swenby's statement, he
simply said it's the truth.
Yeah. Told that to Hagelin.
Yes, sir.
Now, that's not being challenged, right?
It's not challenged that he said that, Your Honor, no.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, semen stains taken from Ms. Leeson's body and a fingerprint found on her discarded student ID could not be linked to either David Binns or Robert Binns. On July 30th, 1999, the criminal complaint for first-degree murder was filed against David Binns and Robert Binns. A joint preliminary hearing was held, but due to the statements of David Binns and questions of their admissibility, the matters were severed for trial purposes. Furthermore, the statements made by David Binns were challenged extensively in pretrial motions. The jury found David guilty of murder on May 12, 2000. Gary Swenby, David's former cellmate and key witness.
Did he receive the same sentence as your client?
Yes, life in prison, Your Honor. Gary Swenby died in an automobile accident between the trials on June 30th, 2000. A court trial was held for Robert Binns on July 24th through 26th of 2000. During that trial, inmates of the Oshkosh Correctional Facility testified to what they heard David Binns say in his sleep. Detective Behamperin read from David's statement in 1987. Detective Hagland testified about David's statement in 1998. A corrections supervisor discussed his conversations with Gary Swenby pertaining to statements made by David Binns. The prosecutor read the statements of Gary Swenby from testimony given at David Binns' trial. Over the continued objections of defense counsel with respect to the admission of David's statements, Robert was found guilty of murder. The new trial was requested, claiming, among other things, that the conviction violated Robert's right of confrontation. That request was denied. The conviction was presented to the Wisconsin Court of Appeals. who upheld the conviction in its decision of July 9, 2002, and the Wisconsin Supreme Court denied review of the appellate court's decision. On June 18, 2003, Robert filed a petition for a writ of habeas corpus with the district court, and on May 28, 2004, Judge Lynn Edelman denied the petition and dismissed the case.
I'm going to just stop you to ask you a question, please,
yes.
Because in discussing harmless error, your reply briefs stated that there were no other witnesses other than the ones whose testimony you now seek to exclude who could sufficiently associate Robert with the murder.
Yes, Your Honor.
And yet, what about Ms. Andrews, Joan Andrews?
Joan Andrews?
Didn't she testify that Robert confessed to her and told her the details of the murder?
He did make some statements not going to the details of the murder. He indicated that he heard some movement in a trunk of a car. He made some general statements, and there was also a falling out between him and Miss Andrus. And it is my position that given that testimony, I believe that if the statements of David Binns would be excluded, that it would be difficult for a trial court to have found him guilty with the evidence presented.
But how do you deal with the argument that Lily was different because there was a police interrogation?
Your Honor, what I would suggest is that Lily is more of a guideline to the spirit of the Confrontation Clause rather than a list of criteria that must be met in order for testimony to either be admitted or not admitted.
Well, but if it's a distinguishable case, why is it unreasonable for the Wisconsin courts to read it narrowly?
Your Honor, are we speaking of the statements between David Swenby or to Gary Swenby or statements by David to the police?
What he said to Swenby.
Your Honor, while there is the statements to Gary Swenby were made with direction of corrections personnel, and I would...
Direction how? He wasn't being interrogated by the police.
No, Your Honor, but the statements were elicited. A corrections supervisor, Bozich, actually told Swenby to go and elicit these statements from David Binns after Swenby had gone to corrections personnel.
And after Swenby had already told...
After Swenby had said that he had made some statements, general statements. And then
statements were certainly not the result of a police interrogation, the initial statements.
Correct, Your Honor.
So why are they necessarily governed by Lilly?
They're not necessarily governed by Lilly, Your Honor. I would just ask that the...
Well, if they're not necessarily governed by Lilly, why are the Wisconsin courts bound? Aren't they allowed to make their own interpretation of Lilly, and as long as it's reasonable, it's proof against a collateral attack?
I would also implicate the dictates of Roberts, Your Honor, that would indicate that there must be particularized guarantees of trustworthiness for particular statements, and I think David making statements...
Well, of course, the argument here is he blurted these things out, he volunteered them. It's not as if the police were, trying to elicit things from him, or that he was trying to shift the blame. Or
how much more was elicited after Swenby was directed by the prison officials to continue his questioning?
I don't think that was ever particularly addressed in the record, Your Honor. Swenby eventually, a month of speaking to Mr. Bent to David Benz. Detective Hagelin from the police department came to interview them and then did a written statement at that point in time. So it may be even hard for Mr. Swenby to have stated what was done before or after that direction.
Okay, you want to save the rest of your time?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, okay.
Thank you.
Mr. Wolf, Ms. Mueller? Ms. Mueller? Is she on? You'll have to speak up, Ms. Mueller.
The court, this is Assistant Attorney General Marguerite Mueller.
Can you hear us?
I can hear you now.
Okay. Well, we can barely hear you, so if you can keep your voice up, it would be helpful.
I assume you could hear the argument, couldn't you?
The only challenge is the ability of David Vincent's statements that are before this court go to the 1987 statement to Detective Pamperin and David's statements to cellmate Gary Swenby. The statements David made in 1998 to Detective Hagelin are not before this court, nor are other statements that he made to inmates other than Gary Swenby, for the reasons that are set forth in the respondent's brief dealing with procedural fault. I think this court needs to keep in mind exactly what statements we are talking about. This case should be analyzed in terms of whether or not Wisconsin Court of Appeals decision finding no confrontation clause violation was contrary to Lilly v. Virginia and Ohio v. Roberts. The U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Crawford really should play no role in this case, because Crawford, having been decided in March of 2004, was not clearly established federal law at the time of the state court's decision. The Wisconsin Court of Appeals decision cannot be held to be contrary to or an unreasonable application of Lilly, because statements that David Benz made in 1987 to Detective Pamperin were far removed from the statements that Mark Benz made to police regarding his brother's participation in a series of crimes. David Benz's statements were very self-inculpatory insofar as he gave the police information showing that he, and not his brother, Robert Benz, had a motive for killing Sandra Leeson. He did not attempt to curry favor with the police. He did not attempt to make his brother seem more culpable. All he did was say that his brother and Miss Sanders had gone to the bar where Miss Leeson was killed or from where she disappeared to buy beer that night. But he put himself in the position of calling the bar and threatening to blow it up and having harsh words with Miss Leeson. So, the Wisconsin Court of Appeals carefully distinguished Lilly's situation from that of the statements made by David Benz in 1987. As for the statements that were made to Gary Swenby, the Wisconsin Court of Appeals did a careful analysis under Ohio v. Roberts and Lilly and explained why these statements were not about the admission of these statements was not a violation of the Confrontation Clause. And I think that opposing counsel has basically admitted that Lilly is very different factually from the situation here. Swenby, first of all, approached David Vince because David Vince was talking in his sleep and making comments about killing a woman and make sure she's dead. So the impetus for Swenby's questioning, first of all, came from these nightmares, the sleep talk that he was listening to David Vince say while they were selling. And while it's true that after Swenby approached this was hardly tantamount to any kind of police interrogation. It was more or less Swenby just asking David Finn more details about the crime, which he then funneled to correctional authorities.
Miss Mueller, this is Judge Rovner. Hello. Does it seem odd at all to you to have a rule that confessions to fellow inmates, like those to family and friends, bear sufficient indicia of reliability to be placed before a jury without, you know, confrontation of the declarant? After all, prisoners are known to brag about crimes that they haven't committed to increase their status in prison or as a defense mechanism to bolster their image as a tough guy to better not be crossed. And prisoners have been known to fabricate all sorts of stories about cellmate concessions in order to curry favor with authorities. Why should we think that such confessions are sufficiently reliable?
Well, I would say that it is odd insofar as there would be any kind of a bright line rule that as a general matter, statements admitted to crimes that are given to fellow inmates are always considered reliable. But in the same vein, I think it would also be unwise to have a general rule saying that just because you made a statement to a family member that that would necessarily be reliable, because I think you do have to look at all of the circumstances surrounding the making of the statement. And insofar as we're talking about David's statement to Gary Swenby, I think the fact that they were started by his sleep talk and by the nightmares he was continually having that caused Swenby to ask him about what these dreams were about. I think the circumstances surrounding the initial making of the statement is what renders them more reliable than, say, the run-of-the-mill statement that might be seen as just braggadocio on the part of an inmate or other fellow prisoner.
If Crawford were applicable, would you have any case?
Definitely, because I think that the statements that were made to Swenby were non-testimonial. They don't bear any of the hallmarks of the kind of formal, accusatory type of characteristics that testimonial statements as defined in Crawford would have.
But Crawford wasn't clearly established federal law at the time the state court rendered its decision, was it?
Well, no, I don't believe that Crawford does apply here. I'm just answering just the question that if Crawford were applicable, would I lose? Would the state lose? And I don't believe so because I don't believe the statements to a cellmate are testimonial under any of the three formulations of the definition of testimonial quoted in Crawford. And as for the statements that were made in 1987 to Detective Tamperin, those might very well be testimonial because he did go down to the police station and it was much more structured, police questioning, investigating the murder. However, admission of those statements, I think, was clearly harmless error because of the admission of all of the other evidence, including, as I think Judge Rosner pointed out, the testimony of Joan Andrews, who was a friend or acquaintance of Robert Vince, to whom he made some very damaging admissions. And she did testify at trial, and her testimony was laid out, the critical part, in full in the state brief on direct appeal. So I don't think that even if this court applied proper, that the state would lose. As a final matter, if this court were to find that the Scotton Court of Appeals decision was unreasonable, which I don't really think there's any grounds for calling it that, but if this court were to find that, then any error in the admission of either the 1987 statement or the 1998 statement to Jerry Swenby would be harmless under Brecht versus Abramson because admission of either category of statements did not have a substantial and injurious effect on the verdict for the reasons that were set forth by Judge Edelman in his decision and for the reasons set forth by the respondents in their brief before this court. So unless this court has any further questions, the state would simply ask that the court affirm the judgment and order of the district court.
Okay, thank you very much, Ms. Moeller. Mr. Wolf? How much time does he have? 1 minute?
Your Honors, in reply, I would just ask the court to implicate not only the outline of Lilly as they particularly apply to the statements made by David to the police, but I would also ask that the requirements of Roberts with respect to hearsay evidence be followed, which does demand that these statements bear a particularized guarantee of trustworthiness. The state does ask that with respect to David's statements to police in 98 not be addressed, but as I indicated in my brief, I do feel that they were sufficiently addressed throughout the preliminary memorandum, the brief in support, the reply brief, all the briefs submitted by the petitioner address those particular statements, though no title was given in the preliminary memorandum with respect to those. With respect to David's statements to other inmates, I would ask that the challenge here is David as the declarant making these statements against his brother, Robert. Those particular statements may not have been particularized, but they were generally challenged throughout. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Mr. Wolf. Thank you to both counsel. Next case for argument is Preston versus Wisconsin Health Fund. Mr. Stearman.